just so.
The other class of pleasures, which as we were saying is purely mental, is entirely derived from memory.
What do you mean?
I must first of all analyze memory, or rather perception which is prior to memory, if the subject of our discussion is ever to be properly cleared up.
How will you proceed?
Let us imagine affections of the body which are extinguished before they reach the soul and leave her unaffected. And again, other affections which vibrate through both soul and body and impart a shock to both and to each of them.
Granted.
And the soul may be truly said to be oblivious of the first, but not of the second.
Quite true.
When I say oblivious, do not suppose that I mean forgetfulness in a literal sense, for forgetfulness is the exit of memory, which in this case has not yet entered, and to speak of the loss of that which is not yet in existence, and never has been, is a contradiction, do you see?
Yes.
Then just be so good as to change the terms.
How shall I change them?
Instead of the oblivion of the soul, when you are describing the state in which she is unaffected by the shocks of the body, say unconsciousness.
I see.
And the union or communion of soul and body in one feeling and motion would be properly called consciousness.
Most true.
Then now we know the meaning of the word.
Yes.
And memory may, I think, be rightly described as the preservation of consciousness.
Right.
But do we not distinguish memory from recollection?
I think so.
And do we not mean by recollection the power which the soul has of recovering, when by herself, some feeling which she experienced when in company with the body?
Certainly.
And when she recovers of herself the lost recollection of some consciousness or knowledge, the recovery is termed recollection and reminiscence.
Very true.
There is a reason why I say all this.
What is it?
I want to attain the plainest possible notion of pleasure and desire, as they exist in the mind only, apart from the body, and the previous analysis helps to show the nature of both.
And now, Socrates, let us proceed to the next point.
There are certainly many things to be considered in discussing the generation and whole complexion of pleasure. At the outset, we must determine the nature and seat of desire.
Hey, let us inquire into that, for we shall lose nothing.
Nay, Protarchus, we shall surely lose the puzzle if we find the answer.
A fair retort, but let us proceed.
Did we not place hunger, thirst, and the like in the class of desires?
Certainly.
And yet they are very different. What common nature have we in view when we call them by a single name?
By heavens, Socrates, that is a question which is not easily answered, but it must be answered.
Then let us go back to our examples.
Where shall we begin?
Do we mean anything when we say a man thirsts?
Yes.
We mean to say that he is empty.
Of course.
And is not thirst desire?
Yes, of drink.
Would you say of drink, or of replenishment with drink?
I should say, of replenishment with drink.
Then he who is empty desires, as would appear, the opposite of what he experiences, for he is empty, and desires to be full.
Clearly so.
But how can a man who is empty for the first time attain either by perception or memory to any apprehension of replenishment, of which he has no present or past experience?
Impossible.
And yet he who desires, surely desires something.
Of course.
He does not desire that which he experiences, for he experiences thirst, and thirst is emptiness, but he desires replenishment.
True.
Then there must be something in the thirsty man which in some way apprehends replenishment.
There must.
And that cannot be the body, for the body is supposed to be emptied.
Yes.
The only remaining alternative is that the soul apprehends the replenishment by the help of memory, as is obvious, for what other way can there be?
I cannot imagine any other.
But do you see the consequence?
What is it?
That there is no such thing as desire of the body.
Why so?
Why? Because the argument shows that the endeavor of every animal is to the reverse of his bodily state.
Yes.
And the impulse which leads him to the opposite of what he is experiencing proves that he has a memory of the opposite state.
True.
And the argument, having proved that memory attracts us towards the objects of desire, proves also that the impulses and the desires, and the moving principle in every living being have their origin in the soul.
Most true.
The argument will not allow that a body either hungers or thirsts, or has any similar experience.
Quite right.
Let me make a further observation. The argument appears to me to imply that there is a kind of life which consists in these affections.
Of what affections, and of what kind of life, are you speaking?
I am speaking of being emptied and replenished, and of all that relates to the preservation and destruction of living beings, as well as of the pain which is felt in one of these states, and of the pleasure which succeeds to it.
True.
And what would you say of the intermediate state?
What do you mean by intermediate?
I mean when a person is in actual suffering, and yet remembers past pleasures which, if they would only return, would relieve him, but as yet he has them not. May we not say of him that he is in an intermediate state?
Certainly.
Would you say that he was wholly pained or wholly pleased?
Nay, I should say that he has two pains. In his body there is the actual experience of pain, and in his soul longing and expectation.
What do you mean, Protarchus, by the two pains? May not a man who is empty have at one time a sure hope of being filled, and at other times be quite in despair?
Very true.
And has he not the pleasure of memory, when he is hoping to be filled, and yet in that he is empty is he, not at the same time in pain?
Certainly.
Then man and the other animals have at the same time both pleasure and pain?
I suppose so.
But when a man is empty, and has no hope of being filled, there will be the double experience of pain. You observed this and inferred that the double experience was the single case possible.
Quite true, Socrates.
Shall the inquiry into these states of feeling be made the occasion of raising a question?
What question?
Whether we ought to say that the pleasures and pains of which we are speaking are true or false, or some true and some false.
But how, Socrates, can there be false pleasures and pains?
And how, Protarchus, can there be true and false fears, or true and false expectations, or true and false opinions?
I grant that opinions may be true or false, but not pleasures.
What do you mean? I am afraid that we are raising a very serious inquiry.
There I agree.
And yet, my boy, for you are one of Philebus' boys, the point to be considered is whether the inquiry is relevant to the argument.
Surely.
No tedious and irrelevant discussion can be allowed. What is said should be pertinent.
Right.
I am always wondering at the question which has now been raised.
How so?
You deny that some pleasures are false, and others true.
To be sure I do.
Would you say that no one ever seemed to rejoice, and yet did not rejoice, or seemed to feel pain, and yet did not feel pain, sleeping or waking, mad or lunatic?
So we have always held, Socrates.
But were you right? Shall we inquire into the truth of your opinion?
I think that we should.
Let us then put into more precise terms the question which has arisen about pleasure and opinion. Is there such a thing as opinion?
Yes.
And such a thing as pleasure?
Yes.
And an opinion must be of something?
True.
And a man must be pleased by something?
Quite correct.
And whether the opinion be right or wrong, makes no difference, it will still be an opinion?
Certainly.
And he who is pleased, whether he is rightly pleased or not, will always have a real feeling of pleasure.
Yes, that is also quite true.
Then, how can opinion be both true and false, and pleasure true only, although pleasure and opinion are both equally real?
Yes, that is the question.
You mean that opinion admits of truth and falsehood, and hence becomes not merely opinion, but opinion of a certain quality, and this is what you think should be examined?
Yes.
And further, even if we admit the existence of qualities in other objects, may not pleasure and pain be simple and devoid of quality?
Clearly.
But there is no difficulty in seeing that pleasure and pain as well as opinion have qualities, for they are great or small, and have various degrees of intensity, as was indeed said long ago by us.
Quite true.
And if badness attaches to any of them, Protarchus, then we should speak of a bad opinion, or of a bad pleasure.
Quite true, Socrates.
And if rightness attaches to any of them, should we not speak of a right opinion or right pleasure, and in like manner of the reverse of rightness?
Certainly.
And if the thing opined be erroneous, might we not say that the opinion, being erroneous, is not right or rightly opined?
Certainly.
And if we see a pleasure or pain which errs in respect of its object, shall we call that right or good, or by any honorable name?
Not if the pleasure is mistaken, how could we?
And surely pleasure often appears to accompany an opinion which is not true, but false.
Certainly it does, and in that case, Socrates, as we were saying, the opinion is false, but no one could call the actual pleasure false.
How eagerly, Protarchus, do you rush to the defense of pleasure?
Nay, Socrates, I only repeat what I hear.
And is there no difference, my friend, between that pleasure which is associated with right opinion and knowledge, and that which is often found in all of us associated with falsehood and ignorance?
There must be a very great difference between them.
Then, now let us proceed to contemplate this difference.
Lead, and I will follow.
Well, then, my view is...
What is it?
We agree, do we not, that there is such a thing as false, and also such a thing as true opinion?
Yes.
And pleasure and pain, as I was just now saying, are often consequent upon these, upon true and false opinion, I mean.
Very true.
And do not opinion and the endeavor to form an opinion always spring from memory and perception?
Certainly.
Might we imagine the process to be something of this nature?
Of what nature?
An object may be often seen at a distance not very clearly, and the seer may want to determine what it is which he sees.
Very likely.
Soon he begins to interrogate himself.
In what manner?
He asks himself, what is that which appears to be standing by the rock under the tree? This is the question which he may be supposed to put to himself when he sees such an appearance.
True.
To which he may guess the right answer, saying as if in a whisper to himself, it is a man.
Very good.
Or again, he may be misled, and then he will say, no, it is a figure made by the shepherds.
Yes.
And if he has a companion, he repeats his thought to him in articulate sounds, and what was before an opinion has now become a proposition.
Certainly.
But if he be walking alone, when these thoughts occur to him, he may not unfrequently keep them in his mind for a considerable time.
Very true.
Well, now, I wonder whether you would agree in my explanation of this phenomenon.
What is your explanation?
I think that the soul at such times is like a book.
How so?
Memory and perception meet, and they and their attendant feelings seem to me almost to write down words in the soul, and when the inscribing feeling writes truly, then true opinion and true propositions, which are the expressions of opinion, come into our souls. But when the scribe within us writes falsely, the result is false.
I quite assent and agree to your statement.
I must bespeak your favor also for another artist who is busy at the same time in the chambers of the soul.
Who is he?
The painter, who, after the scribe has done his work, draws images in the soul of the things which he has described.
But when and how does he do this?
When a man, besides receiving from sight or some other sense certain opinions or statements, sees in his mind the images of the subjects of them. Is not this a very common mental phenomenon?
Certainly.
And the images answering to true opinions and words are true, and to false opinions and words false, are they not?
They are.
If we are right so far, there arises a further question.
What is it?
Whether we experience the feeling of which I am speaking only in relation to the present and the past, or in relation to the future also?
I should say in relation to all times alike.
Have not purely mental pleasures and pains been described already, as in some cases anticipations of the bodily ones, from which we may infer that anticipatory pleasures and pains have to do with the future?
Most true.